Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Empowerment Hour. I can promise you there will be in-depth conversation. We will not be reciting the same tired litany of stories that you hear on the left and the right media. We will take you to where I believe that we can have a more reasoned judgment about what's going on in the world. The latest on healing, health, alternative medicine, inside stories on the environment you will not hear elsewhere, and a special commentary or two, including one from Chris Hedges, Obama's health care bill is enough to make you sick, from Truth Dig. Also, very important, we will give you the guest that has insights into the future that will, well, make you think. Professor Robert Jensen, on trying to define the emotional anguish Americans are living in with an impending collapse of our entire system. And we'll go through that in depth. Let's begin with the latest in health and healing. I'm a big believer in olive oil. I think it's one of the most important oils we can put into our body. I also believe that olives are very good, and it would be good to have maybe 6-7 olives a day, and different variety of olives. Here's the reason why. This is from The Guardian. It says the Mediterranean diet, low in red meat and dairy, but high in fruits, vegetables, nuts, whole grains, and olive oil, is considered to contain the best selection of foods to help prevent cancer. It is certainly the diet recommended by nutritionists. Out of this diet, olive oil has just emerged as a serious attacker of breast cancer tumors, according to scientists in Spain. Quote, it thwarts the gene that drives the growth of breast cancer tumors. It switches off proteins the cancer cells rely on in order to grow and multiply, and it protects the DNA from damage that can lead to cancer, unquote. What's important about this is that cherries, along with olives, both help prevent cancer, and yet we're not really told that in the United States, but it's in the scientific literature. And we have a whole group of people in about 6 different countries in the Western Mediterranean who have very low incidence of breast cancer, very low incidence of congestive heart failure and colorectal cancer, conditions we take for granted in our society. Cherries contain an alcohol which has been proven to fight breast cancer. Broccoli, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts transfer unhealthy estrogens into healthy ones. Tomatoes contain lycopene, which has anti-cancer properties. Green tea is packed full of antioxidants, which prevent cancer cells from growing, as do flaxseed, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, and blueberries. All of these are anti-cancer. They're all popular in the Mediterranean diet. And it's not uncommon, if you've been to Spain or Italy, to have all those in one day, especially the way they eat. One item at a time, on a small plate, but many different plates. Like you would eat a salad, and then an antipasto, and then maybe a pasta, and a piece of fish. They don't put it all on one plate the way we do. And they take a long time in eating. And wonderful seasoning. The best garlic I've ever eaten in my life was in Spain. And they cooked it. In fact, when it was served, it was golden. And it was very sweet. And I asked him for a lot of garlic, because I generally eat a cup of garlic a day. And I went into their kitchen, which was a very small kitchen. It was in a port city in Spain. And in San Sebastian, and I'm looking at the smallest kitchen I've ever seen in a restaurant. It couldn't have been more than 8 feet long and maybe 6 feet wide. It was tiny. And here's this guy who was sauteing the garlic, and I looked at the flame and it was very low, and I said, how long does it take to make your garlic? He said, if you do it right, at low temperature, it'll take about 10 minutes. He says, if you do it at a high temperature, you're going to scorch the garlic and make it taste bitter. and you don't want to eat it raw. You want that goldenness, and he had perfected it. And the oil he used was an olive oil, but he said you never use olive oil at high temperature. And that's the key. Anyhow, joining olive oil and all the things I just mentioned at the top of the list to help prevent breast cancer is garlic. It's been seen to actively destroy cancer cells. Turmeric, which is not only an antioxidant, but it also contains curcumin, is known to kill cancerous cells, at least when they're in the microscopic stage. And put all that together, and you have the Mediterranean diet. And add in olives as well. Good ways to prevent cancer. Now, for those who do not care about their diet, and that's a lot of people in the United States, and those who eat out at fast food restaurants, who will not take the time to select the right foods and to prepare them, to juice, to have a lot of good raw foods in their diet, you run the risk of speeding up the age of your cell. I estimate that it's about twice as old biologically as it is chronologically. So let's say that you should live to be about 150 years with no disease. We're sick and dead by 74, 75 in most people. So we're only living half of our biological age. That's because our chronological age, because our biological age is affected by everything we do, and it's all cumulative. There's no such thing as getting away with anything. At some level, you pay a price for every choice you make, and it's always cumulative. So when someone says, why do I have breast cancer, Gary? I don't smoke. Did you ever smoke? Well, yeah, but back then, I don't drink. Did you ever drink? Yep, back then. Did you take any drugs? Not now, but I did back then. You're eating good now, but I didn't back then. Well, back then is when the damage occurs. It would be like you taking a jackhammer and cutting out a large section of your living room floor and then throwing a very thick rug over it. Sooner or later, you're going to step on that big hole with the rug and you're just going to sink right through. That's the tipping point. We don't look at what leads up to the tipping point. We only look at the symptoms and consequences of something tipping. And we do that with all the systems in our lives. Now, that's particularly important for women. Last year, I completed a study on menopausal women. To get into the study, you had to be in menopause with a whole series of symptoms, or recently postmenopausal. At the completion of 1 year, for all the women who completed the study, there was upwards of 95% changes in their biology. We turned off hot flashes and night sweat, remineralized the bones, changed the weight. People lost weight, had more energy, didn't have the mood swings, overcame depression. Many of the things that we consider common for menopause. And in fact, the World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicines Division of the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine selected it as one of the keynote presentation reports at a congress of about 7,000 anti-aging experts this year. I've been so busy filming, I didn't have a chance to go. I was supposed to go to London, I couldn't. Then Las Vegas, Chicago, Orlando. I've missed all of them. I'll make the next one because I'm now finished with my principal photography on my major documentaries. And I'll make a presentation. And I'll show that you can reverse menopause. You heard me right, reverse menopause, which means you reverse all the symptoms, the thinning of the skin, the loss of muscle mass, the loss of libido, the drying out of the mucous membranes in the vagina, making it impossible or very painful for many women to have normal intimacy because of the chafing and infections that come from it. Constant urinary tract infections, you name the problems, many women suffer from them. Here's the latest one, and why we should be concerned about this. This is in the University of Alabama, and it was published in the Endocrine Society's journal. And it says, women who experience an early menopause run twice the risk of a heart attack or a stroke later in life. Early menopause was defined as going through menopause before age 46, either naturally or surgically through removal of both ovaries, a hysterectomy. Quote, it is important for women to know that early menopause is a potential risk factor for cardiovascular disease, the number one killer of women in America. This is from Professor Wellens, a fellow at the University of Alabama. Now, why is this important? Because everything we do and think becomes a part of what causes a premature aging that throws a woman who would normally not go through menopause till 5 or 10 years later into going through menopause early. We now know that chronic stress releases cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine. We know that being overweight and having an elevated blood sugar level, which is causing a lot of hormone challenge, because on the bottom end you have glucagon, on the high end you have insulin trying to either bring down your blood sugar to normal, and if it's too low, bring it back up again. You're on a seesaw all day long. All of this prematurely ages your cells. It speeds up your biological clock. You literally are living your life as if you're watching a movie with the remote put on fast forward. That now is shown to increase your risk of heart attack or stroke. So in order to live a longer life and a healthier life, you've got to slow down and really detox and rejuvenate and rebalance. Wine could boost memory and learning ability. And this is a good study published in the most prestigious journal in the world, Nature. And it was done at MIT. And it says the following. MIT's Mike Hauer Institute for Learning and Memory has found that resveratrol, which is found in wine and activates a group of enzymes known as sirtuins, might now help to boost memory and brain power. Quote, we demonstrated previously that sirtuin 1 promotes neuronal survival in age-dependent neurodegenerative disorders. In our cell mouse models for Alzheimer's disease, it promoted neuron survival, reduced neurodegeneration, and prevented learning impairment. So what this means is start drinking more real good organic grape juice. Eat more organic grapes. Or take about 200 to 400 milligrams of resveratrol each day and help your memory. Good information. I guess it was in 1977 I did my first report on the healing benefits of walnuts. I'd been in California, and I was interested in the Seventh-day Adventist because one group of Seventh-day Adventists were vegetarian and another group were not, and they were comparing the health benefits to a study at Loma Linda University, which is one of the more important medical schools in the country, and showed that those that ate a handful of walnuts each week had less heart disease. That was the beginning. There's lots of studies now showing why pistachios, almonds, walnuts are all important in your diet. This is just one more added to that. This was done at the University of California at Los Angeles. They monitored 4,800 people over 65 and found that those who drank tea regularly, that would probably primarily be green tea, had a 37% less likelihood of having a mental reduction. But they also found that walnuts, quote, are high in antioxidants, omega-3 fatty acids, and can help prevent dementia. And this was at New York State Institute also. They carried out a study on walnuts. The other carried out a study on tea. So, quote, walnuts may have a beneficial effect in reducing the risk, delaying the onset or slowing progression of Alzheimer's disease, unquote. So you have two studies, New York State Institute saying walnuts will help prevent dementia, and then you have a Harvard Medical School study showing that exercise reduces dementia by 40%, and then you have another study suggesting that a cup of tea can stave off mental decline. The University of California shows that those who drink tea regularly are going to have better mental abilities. So all in all, eat your walnuts, drink your green tea, and you're less likely to age mentally as will other individuals. And one final study, and this is from the AYU Department of Ayurveda, and it says the following: homeopathic drug may prevent swine flu. And this is from the Central Council for Research in Homeopathy. And, quote, the experts suggest that homeopathic medicine could be taken as preventive medicine against the flu-like illnesses, including swine flu. The doctors recommended Arsenicum Album 30, four pills of size 30 for adults and two pills for children a day on empty stomach for 3 days. And that was in their journal. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away. Wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay.
I'd like to welcome all of you joining us around the world. I'm Gary Noll. My guest is Professor Robert Jensen. He is professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a longtime radical social activist. His writings cover radical feminist critiques of pornography, postmodern masculinity, race issues, and foreign policy and politics. And recently, he conducted an online personalized survey to gather emotional actions from people around the nation about the particular economic, political, environmental, and social challenges and crises that most Americans are facing. We're going to try to define the emotional anguish Americans are living in with a pending collapse. He is the author of several books, including All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to a Prophetic Voice, Getting Off Pornography and the End of Masculinity, and Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Great to be with you, Gary. Thanks.
Robert, I'm going to give you just a little extended intro and then give you all the time necessary to explore this. I just wanted to bring in some headlines to show you just today what people are faced with, all right?
Sure.
One headline today, and this is Halliburton continues to flood lawmakers with contributions after oil spill. This is from Common Dreams' Michael Beckel. It says, Halliburton, the company once headed by former Republican Vice President Dick Cheney, contributed money to federal candidates during June, and that amounts to the third largest month of donations by PACs this election cycle. So once again, Halliburton making sure that all Democrats and Republicans that could impact anything they're involved with are dealt with. Then we have the New York Times yesterday saying happy days are here again, in essence. I would like to challenge the New York Times and just lay out what many Americans are feeling, which allows us to feel a crisis that my guest, Professor Robert Jensen, is going to discuss. For example, did the New York Times tell you that the National League of Cities says that municipal governments will probably end up at about $83 billion short between now and 2012? The two university professors recently calculated the combined unfunded pension liabilities for all 50 states was over $3 trillion. That 32 U.S. states have already run out of funds to pay people who are unemployed. That there are almost 40 million Americans now on food stamps, which is the highest in its history. And that doesn't cover everyone who will be using the program this year. They estimate upwards another 5 million. That what is the number one city in the United States for auto theft? New York City? Los Angeles? No. It's Phoenix, Arizona. 57,000 vehicles stolen. We were told 2 years ago that there was 125,000 gang members in the United States. Gerald Salonta and I did several programs about one of the things we are not discussing anywhere in the United States, not on any of the talk shows, left or right, or mainstream, about gangs. And what will happen when the cities have so little funds that they can only provide essential services on an intermittent basis to those who are in the suburbs or outer areas, and even in the boroughs, and mainly use what they have for their core high-end living environments. So if you're rich, well, you'll be in a green zone. If you're not, then you're going to be lacking some of the services. The latest study is this. Listen to this. Quote, U.S. law enforcement authorities now state that there are over 1 million members of criminal gangs inside the United States. That's up 80% in crime, of all crimes committed in the United States. Now, put yourself in this position. Let's say that you're a 16-year-old young man. Your mother is faced with losing her job. You have a sister who's younger and a brother who's younger, and you're looking at homelessness. You're looking at living in a car if you have one, and without the benefit of in-laws to sleep on their couch. Someone comes to you and says, we'll keep you in your home. We'll see that you have food. Join our gang. How many people looking at the consequences of the new poor in America will make that choice? I believe that we're going to see a rather substantial number of people going into gangs who might not otherwise have chosen to, but the circumstances of a society that's turned the back on homeless people and the poor and the disadvantaged is going to be a breeding ground for crime. And 10% of all gang members are former military. Remember that, and how high those figures can go. According to an analysis by the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation, the health care reform bill is actually going to generate over $400 billion in additional taxes. And the average person is stuck with credit card bills they can't pay. So if you have a credit card bill of $6,000 and you just make ends meet by paying what you can, you're going to pay an average of $30,000, depending upon interest, for a $6,000 bill. Now you know why your credit card companies don't mind that you pay forever, the rest of your life, on a bill, because you're paying astronomical fees. A few more things. If you want to see how long it takes, or what by what standards it takes to spend $1 trillion, and we have given the major corporations in the United States, including Wall Street, $13.3 trillion guarantees and bailouts, if you want to spend $1 million a day, you would have to go back to the time before Christ's birth and spend $1 million a day. You still would not have spent it all. The debt, domestic debt of the United States government, is 90% of our gross domestic product. If you add in all of the debt, including corporate and personal debt, it's 360% of our gross domestic product. There are now 8 counties in the state of California that have unemployment rates over 20%. And in the area around Sacramento, California, there's 1 closed business for every 6 that are open. Why don't we know about this? Why don't we know? Why aren't we told all this going on? 1.4 million Americans filed for personal bankruptcy last year. That's 32% increase over 2008, and it's growing this year. And 37% of all Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 have either been unemployed or unemployed at some point during the past 2 years. And 40% of those who are employed in the United States are now working in low-wage service jobs. And that's just some of that. Now, adding 2 more headlines on, crisis awaits world's banks as trillions come due. One sentence here from Jack Ewing, New York Times. The sovereign debt crisis would seem to create worry enough for European banks, but there's another gathering threat that has not garnered notice. The trillions of dollars in short-term borrowing that institutions around the world must repay or roll over in the next 2 years, and they don't have the money to do it. And finally, the biggest threat to America's future, the U.S. free trade deficit, and quote one paragraph from Warren Buffett. The U.S. trade deficit is a bigger threat to the domestic economy than either the federal budget deficit or consumer debt, and could lead to political turmoil. No economic issue today is more pressing than the U.S. trade deficit. This predicament should be America's top priorities. It is also a key reason why we have high unemployment. Yet most people in the United States do not understand the silent killer or what they can do about it. Even most economists are very defensive of our free trade policy, yet none of them can defend free trade's 1,000-pound gorilla in the room, the U.S. yearly trade deficit. And then it goes on to talk about how serious it is. We've been averaging $555 billion a year for the past 10 years. Or what do we owe? The U.S. trade deficit since 1971 is $7.5 trillion. And by comparison, the national debt is now $13 trillion. So that's something you don't hear broadcast about. So that's just part of the problem. Now, to you, and thank you for your patience, Robert Jensen, for letting me explain that just as part of the context of our discussion.
Well, to me, I think the problem goes beyond just the manifestations of the pathology of these systems, but to the systems itself. So we talk about economic problems. Of course, the core is that capitalism, the system that structures the world economy, is a fundamentally unsustainable and undemocratic system. It concentrates wealth, thereby concentrating power and destroying democracy, and it leads to an unsustainable human relationship with the ecosystem. So when we look at the specific manifestations of this in terms of debt or trade imbalances or something, what we're really eventually going to have to come to terms with is the pathological nature of the system itself. And I think that the difficulty that the culture has doing that is a huge impediment. Now, even though that's difficult to bring up in the mainstream, the point of the piece I wrote is that around the edges, on the margins, there are many people starting to come to terms with the fundamental collapse of this system. Now, when you start talking about collapse, a lot of people accuse you of being apocalyptic or, you know, dabbling in kind of crazy ideas. But I think that the markers of collapse are quite clear. By that, I don't mean that anyone, me or anyone else, can give you a date on which the system is going to no longer function, because, of course, in a complex global economy like this, a system doesn't shut down overnight. We're talking about a process, and we have to get a handle on that process, and the first step is to tell the truth about it. The problem, I think, that people have in telling that truth is, in part, that the consequences of that truth are really quite dire, that because we have been slow to deal with this over the past, the consequences of the industrial model of human relationship to the ecosystem, a kind of extraction economy where we treat the world as either, you know, a giant mine or a giant garbage pit. The idea that the relatively short period of time in which we've had this access to an enormous amount of cheap energy that's produced the so-called lifestyle that we have, that all of these things, when you start adding them up, become, in a sense, overwhelming, and people, when faced with an overwhelming situation like that, I think tend to avoid it. So the point of my piece and my query to people about reporting on their own experience is, how do we start to face that? And I think that process is going to start from the margins, where people have been willing to face that kind of truth. It's not going to start in the mainstream. It's not going to start in Washington or New York or in any of the centers of power. It's certainly not going to start in the universities, you know, where I teach and live out my life. It's going to come from people on the margins who are experimenting in new ways to organize an economy, new ways to organize themselves socially, and dealing with experiments in new ways to be alive in the ecosystem. And I think that's where the most important political action is. Most people don't even think of that as political, but it does dramatically affect the way power and wealth are distributed, and therefore, from my point of view, it's the heart of politics.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Now let's go into this in depth. I was just referring to the economic model. We must also take into account the chemical pollution model. Every single study shows that our air is unfit for human breathing, our water. There's not a clean drop of water any longer in the United States unless it's filtered. and the food we eat is highly processed. We have a healthcare crisis, an obesity epidemic in children, diabetes epidemic, cancer epidemic, inflammation epidemics. We have an epidemic in mental conditions such as dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, all of which, or at least 95% of which, is self-induced. It's not genetic. We then have to look at the largest ecological disaster in the world, which we would like to believe is just related to this oil spill in the Gulf. How about something three times the size of Texas, the plastic island in the Pacific? And we can continue looking at pollutants, but these are reaching tipping points. So we have an ecological, environmental, chemical pollution. We have a federal deficit. We have increased military spending on wars, military adventurism that cannot be sustained. And yet you never hear anyone, either on the left or on the right, demanding that we start taking these budgets apart in order to save social programs or to do something with that money in a more meaningful way. In fact, this president, all the rest have given more. I believe, are approaching in the very near future, because of all this and because of the unmitigated greed and of the people in power, social and civil threats. I believe that there will be a breakdown of rule and order in segments of the population. And I'm just finishing this week looking at Gulf War vets that I filmed that are living in little tiny pup tents in the woods. And we're talking about thousands of them. No one knew they were there because no one was willing to look at it. No one was willing to help them. And when I ask these people, has anyone from the local media been here? Has Sean Hannity been here and Glenn Beck, since they tell everyone to support the Gulf vets? Or do they support you when you come home, when you end up with poverty? No, they don't. No one's been there. So you start to take a look around at how much pain is going on in the United States and the emotional anguish that goes with it. That's a serious prescription for individual collapse, social collapse. Could you then go through with us each of the possible collapses that you see and tell us what it is that you see, how people are responding to it, and what we could do about it?
Sure. I agree with much of what you say. Just one footnote. I think the left, in fact, has been talking about this. If by left we mean the anti-capitalist, anti-empire left, I don't mean the left in terms of the Democratic Party.
That's what I was referring
to.
Yeah,
the Democratic Party, of course, is not really left. It's liberal, but not left in some sense. So there is a political tradition that has, you know, for now centuries been making these critiques. And I think that we have to look to the movements that have had the best analysis in the past. And I think the deep ecology movement is one of them. The political left is another. I think radical feminism is another, where you can find people who for a long time have been pointing to these systemic problems. Now, you said let's go through the collapses, because it is, of course, plural. We've already talked at some length about the ecological collapse, and I think it's important to talk in these terms. We're used to talking about environmental problems, so we're used to talking about the problem of water pollution or air pollution, but I think, as you're pointing out, that all of these stack up into not individual problems that can be addressed and fixed, but a systemic collapse rooted in the way that we have been living, especially in this high energy, high technology era. And that means a radical redefinition of who we are as people, how we relate to each other, and of course how we relate to that larger ecosystem. Again, none of this should be mistaken for some sort of crazy apocalyptic ranting about some date in the future that you can predict the end of the world. That's not what we're talking about. So the ecological collapse is primary, of course, because if the ecosystem itself can't support human life as we understand it, then it's game over. But I think you're also pointing to a number of other systems. I would describe it as a political and economic and a cultural collapse. The economic collapse you've spoken about, the fact that this predatory corporate capitalist system, which is essentially a wealth concentrating system, no matter what the ideologues of the capitalist system say, what capitalism does in practice is concentrate wealth. And concentrations of wealth undermine a decent society. You cannot have the kind of grotesque inequalities that we have and imagine an ongoing, sustainable, decent society. Those inequalities, of course, exist worldwide. If you look at global statistics, roughly about half the world's population at this point lives on less than $2.50 a day. That means half the world's population is in some state of abject poverty. You cannot have a world that goes on indefinitely like that. And of course, economic inequality within the United States is growing considerably as well. So we can see that the basic distribution of wealth in contemporary corporate capitalism violates everyone's fundamental moral principles and creates an inequality that's not only unacceptable morally, but as you're pointing out, also very dangerous because it creates instability. So we have a political crisis that arises from this, because when you concentrate wealth, of course, you also concentrate power. I don't know of any system in which the concentration of wealth doesn't, in fact, lead to political power being concentrated. And that undermines the basic precepts of liberal democracy. So the kind of, if you look at the post-World War II era in the United States, an era of great economic expansion, and a flowering of certain kind of political freedom, I think that's very much in jeopardy given the current state of the economy. And of course, in addition to a political and an economic collapse, I think we have to talk about a cultural collapse. We have to talk about, for instance, the way in which sexuality and violence are now so ubiquitous in this culture that they're almost like background noise. In addition to a lot of the other work I've done, I've been a part of a feminist critique of pornography, and I think that's one place where you see it most. The concentration of sexualized cruelty and violence in this major entertainment medium. Well, those are signs of a culture that's eroding, where the bonds of solidarity and compassion are giving way. And that, I think, is also connected to the economic crisis, because in capitalism, of course, what does it mean to be a human being? Well, a human being is just someone who maximizes his or her own self-interest. Literally, the definition of being human in capitalism is simply about self-interest and greed. Also in capitalism, the market absorbs everything it can. So human relationships that previous to this era were not market transactions now become part of the market. And I think that undermines a culture as well. So, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons, as you were pointing out, to be very afraid. And I think the fear is not hysterical. Anytime you start talking like this again, people want to dismiss it as kind of craziness. But I think more and more people are starting to recognize that we're at a very crucial moment in human history. And the responses I got to my article, in which I asked people to report back on how they're coping with these matters, certainly indicated that there's a growing number of people who share this concern and want to try and do something about it.
I'd like to add a little comment onto that. I don't see the type of vital activism today in the way that we're facing our crisis as we did as being a part of the 60s youth movements. The ethic of civil duty has, today it's eroded to such degree that we should not expect much positive coming from the nation's main core right and left. I think you have to go beyond that. And finally, I believe that we must take an honest look at the overlap between theology and the brutal fundamentalism that it permeates almost everything in our society, particularly when it comes in different disguises. And what we see is the fundamentalism such as the Christian right, and the fundamentalism ideology of free market capitalism, and the fundamentalism of the bright and brightest like Obama and others steering our corporatocracy, or contributing and fueling collapse rather than alleviating. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, In fact, in the last book I wrote, which is called All My Bones Shake, I talk about the four, what I would describe as the four fundamentalisms. Obviously, religious fundamentalism is a huge threat, but so are, as you pointed out, the kind of market fundamentalism or economic fundamentalism in capitalism. There's a national fundamentalism that is connected to this hyper-patriotic jingoism of states like the U.S. especially. And there's also what I would describe as a technological fundamentalism, a belief that all of these problems that have in part been created by the high-energy, high-technology society we have created are now suddenly going to be magically fixed by more high energy, high technology, instead of the more sensible idea that these problems, to the degree they can be fixed, that we can create solutions. The solutions are going to come not from more high energy, high technology, but from, in fact, rethinking the way we understand ourselves and the world in which we live. So all of those fundamentalisms, I agree, are a threat. And the question is, how do we sort of transcend these fundamentalisms that define so much of our modern world? As far as the kind of activism, you know, the 1960s produced political activism that did help change the society in many ways. It's not, from my point of view, that there's a sort of less activism. I think the activism is moving in different directions. I think there's still a lot of important models out there, although the dominant society, I would agree, has sort of fallen into a kind of political apathy. But when I look around at groups that, again, are kind of on the margins, groups that aren't, you know, being talked about much in the mainstream, that's where I see the models. I work, for instance, with a group here in the Austin area called the Workers' Defense Project, which takes on the very important job of trying to defend the rights of some of the most vulnerable people in our society, immigrant workers, especially undocumented immigrant workers. Well, in doing that, it's not only a kind of service to specific workers, it's a critique of the economic structure more generally. It's the attempt to create connections, networks, and institutions outside of the dominant culture. It brings together people from the immigrant community and from the wider dominant society. And it does that in a very creative way. In Austin, we've just bought a building to house a center that's focused on that kind of work, among other kinds of projects. And so there are things going on that I think make a positive contribution, but they are on the margins, and I don't have any illusions. They aren't activities that in the short term are going to radically change society. But I think in a sense, the concept we need to hold on, I'll borrow from a book by James Howard Kunstler, The Long Emergency, the sense that we are in fact in an emergency, that this moment we live in history is as dire as we're speaking of, but that there are no short-term immediate answers to it, and that we have to, in a sense, dig in for that kind of long emergency. Now, I think one can do that without being naive or having an overly optimistic vision of what can happen. I think, you know, it's a way we, in a sense, define what it means to be human by how much we're willing to commit to that project.
Very well said. I also agree it will not come from the mainstream. It will not come from the left or right, because society is neither left nor right. Society is up and down. And those who are on the up end of society believe that they're insulated, they're protected because their wealth and their power and their capacity as policymakers and opinion leaders to decide what the rest of us should be doing with our lives, where we should live, what everything should be. They write the rules and then they enforce them, and they're very selective. And so anyone like yourself or myself or others who would be pushed to the extremes then are not given the credibility, because we're not a part of the best and brightest in their clique. And I think that it's from groups that are on the fringe of society, that five percenters, I say, the proactive, progressive 5% who really care about the world we live in and other human beings, and willing to make some sacrifices to share the best they are with that society, that our future rests not in some new invention that's patented, new drug, or some new smiling face in Washington. Robert Jensen, thank you very much for all the good work you do, and please know that you and the other progressives out there always are welcome on this forum at the Progressive Radio Network.
Great. Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Professor Robert Jensen is the author of All My Bones Shake, and his website is Ask Him. Oh, excuse me. I'm not sure what his website is. Well, we'll get it for you. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Now we're going to open up the phones for you to share your thoughts. Please do. I welcome your input, questions, comments. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. everyone. I'm Gary Noll. I'm going to save my commentary for tomorrow at my noon show because it'll take a little more time than what we have, but we certainly have time to answer your calls if you give us a call at 888-874-4888. You are listening to the number one listened to progressive radio program in the world, and we thank you for making that. Joining me in studio is Kara Lee, our program director here, always looking for important voices, and we have a variety of voices. We create programs for progressive minds, and Bill Thompson, and who has a program on Progressive Radio Network. Kara Lee, we'll start with you until we get some questions in.
All right, great. Well, if I can just say really quickly, we are looking for new shows on the Progressive Radio Network. If you have any ideas or have any comments you would like to send our way, please do at info@progressiveradionetwork.com. That's info@progressiveradionetwork.com. And I also brought with me a news headline, Gary, that I thought you would find interesting, about how Barack Obama says that he's going to boost spending for post-traumatic vets. He said that the government is taking what calls a long-overdue step to aid veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, making it easier for them to receive federal benefits. However, at the same time, he says no longer will the veterans need to prove what caused their illness. Instead, they need to show the conditions surrounding the time and place of the service they have contributed. What do you think this means, Gary? And how far do you think Obama's going to go in helping vets that have come back from service?
No different than Bill Clinton or George Bush. Publicly, they'll say they're for the vets. But they're not. Because none of them were vets, and I don't count that little stint in the National Guard that his daddy got him as anything other than what his daddy got him, including the presidency of the United States, one of the biggest blunders in American history. What we have is we have about 2.5 to 3 million people who've served in the Gulf. The trouble is, if you're a National Guardsman and you've done 2 or 3 tours of duty in the Gulf, do you know that you're not covered under the Veterans Administration's policies?
Why not?
Because they don't consider it as a regular enlisted person. So you can't end up with the VA benefits. But even those that have Gulf War Syndrome, which are 500,000, and there have been over 30 to 75,000 deaths, it's not exact, but Joyce Riley, who's the top person in the vet operations, says you could go as high as 75,000 vets have died because of Gulf War Syndrome. 500,000 are sick. I personally sent Barack Obama, when he was running for office, when he was a junior senator, a complete profile and contained 3 award-winning documentaries I've produced on Gulf War Syndrome, plus 9 articles, and said, these are important. No one's looking after the Gulf vets. Now, yes, if you have a limb, you know, that's blown off and you get a prosthesis, and yes, they do have some good quality care for those who've had severe physical injuries. But post-traumatic stress disorder, they've done little to nothing with. And their idea is just to give them all antipsychotic medication. I mean, that's their therapy. That's not helping them. That's like saying, "Oh, you have AIDS. I'll put you on a good drug. We'll give you a protease inhibitor, or we'll give you AZT." No, then that's not going to help. That's going to kill the person. You have to approach the problems of the Gulf War from post-traumatic stress disorder, increased suicide, increased homelessness, 300,000 minimum are on the streets living. I just filmed some under a bridge. I was up this morning in production going over the, you know, showing their stories, letting them speak for themselves. Then you have those that come home and they're sick. But the VA says constantly, oh, that wasn't due to, you know, your vaccines didn't cause anything. Well, yes, they did. Your exposure to depleted uranium didn't cause your leukemia at age 25. Yes, it did. So Barack Obama has never shown the courage to go up against the military-industrial complex, of which the Pentagon, the Defense Department, VA are part. So like everything else this man says, measure it against what he has done in the past when he has made a promise.
All right, thanks, Gary. Well, I also brought in a couple emails with me, and
all right.
You can send your emails to GaryLive@GaryNoll.com. This is from Aluda, who said that she was, Linda, I apologize, who said she was out working out with her two daughters at the track on Saturday. She said she saw you there and you were racing. She pointed you out to her daughters and they were cheering you on, and you noticed and you smiled back at them. And as they saw you racing, they noticed that you were back behind the other people, and one of her daughters said that you were too far back to win the race. And the last round came around, and by just a second, you got first place. And not only that, you actually won three separate races that day and set three state records. She wants to know, how do you balance all you do, and how do you still succeed so well in sports?
I won by a half a second. Not a second. Half a second.
She was being generous.
And I won by 2 seconds in the mile. And... yes, I did set three state records. That was my 15th win of the year. I get up very early. I train hard very early. The type of training I was doing this time was very similar to what you would see in the movie Rocky. I mean, it's the end of the season. This was the final race for this season. Now I'll have about a month and a half off before I have to start training again for the next season. And I do it for several reasons, not the least of which is to show that you do not have to get old. You do not have to age prematurely. As long as you're willing to use what we can use, you can slow down and actually reverse the aging process. So you don't have to get slower. You don't have to lose body mass. All the myths that we have. And when I see how many great athletes have retired, and they didn't have to retire. It's just that they got lazy. They didn't train year-round. They didn't train holistically. And these were great athletes, and I believe that they could still be playing the game today and inspiring us and have that joy of great athletics in male or female. So I'm trying to show people that there's a new model. Now, there are other people, Sid Howard, Sam Skinner, Louise Nottage, Joan Rowland, Thelma Wilson. They're also out there, and they're winning all the time and setting records because they don't accept that there's an artificial limitation. Okay, you're 50, you're 55, you're 60, you're out of it. No, you're not, says who? So that's one of the reasons I'm doing it. And also because I'm always willing to challenge myself to see what breakthroughs I can give myself to show that there's no need to be in a comfort zone with your life. And that's true in anything and everything. So once you don't accept comfort zone, then you're no longer sitting waiting for just get older. You're still vital every day. Vitalism is crucial to being a happy, healthy person. Okay?
Great, Gary. And this is just one last email that I got. And it was kind of about, you know, somebody, they were curious, they were saying, you know, they like to think that they're, you know, a progressive, independent mind, but, you know, they get swarmed down a lot by the different types of media, you know, the liberal media with Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann, and then you have conservative radio and TV with Michael Savage, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, but if you look carefully, none of the shows are doing too well. As a matter of fact, Glenn Beck's numbers have increasingly gone down throughout the year, and we're increasing in membership. Every week, I'm surprised we're breaking new records and getting more and more listeners. And why do you think this is? And how do you think we're going about in getting new people out there?
That brings me up something that, Bill, you had just finished researching.
Yes, we had, in fact, I wanted to ask you about this, too, because the New York Times reported today that Wall Street's beginning to put on a bunch of new people because they're expecting a big turnaround. And yet, we have this grease issue, which going into the toilet, and we're sort of like following right behind. This is confusing to me. We have one side of the media that's saying everything is a disaster. We have the other side saying that it's not a disaster. They're the disaster. It's just very confusing as to where we're going with all this.
It's only confusing because most of the media, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, and I've spent a lot of time listening to him just to see what he's saying, and Sean Hannity, it's all negative radio. It's all accusatory radio. Then I listen to the left, and it's all accusatory radio. I mean, how many times do you want to see Keith Urban make Glenn Beck his, you know, worst person in the world?
Yes.
And but when was the last time he talked about going specifically through the Obama health care bill to show you how bad it is? Because if you did that, then you have to make the people who made it bad responsible for making it bad. So you just don't deal with it. Oh, it was better than nothing. No, it wasn't.
No.
And tomorrow I'll show you. So what you have, you've only had two people framing all arguments in the United States. Two people. One representing left, one representing right. All right. Now the people see that that's not the way it works, and they want to see other issues explored from other sides. In comes the independents. And finally, people give up one day saying, I can no longer be a good Democrat because you betrayed the democratic principles. I can no longer be a good conservative because you're not really conservative. You're hypocritical. You condemn socialism, and yet you, as a corporate person, are the beneficiary of socialism in massive amounts. You would hate a woman who gets a kid and gets a welfare check, but you don't mind getting a billions-dollar welfare check for your corporation if you're big agri, big pharma, or big military-industrial complex, or big insurance. So because of the overt hypocritical nature of the left and the right, because the lack of scholarship, lack of real honest discourse, people are going independent. From inside the independent movement, there is now an emergence of new minds and new voices that are able to look at everything differently. Remember, when you're no longer aligned to an ideology, you see the whole picture. When you're in an ideology, you can only see the picture that you're told to see. And therefore, you don't see the truth as it is. You only see a truth edited for you. The progressives in America represent the people capable of seeing the truth and speaking it. At one time, we were so insignificant that we were mocked. Today, we're the largest voice in America. We're over 44% and growing. Let's see what happens when a third party emerges, a progressive party, when we have the Ralph Naders and we have great minds that are able to speak the truth, then watch how bad the left and right looks. We're out of time. Thank you all very much for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.
Just as long.